Well, good morning, friends. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It is the 26th of April, and I hope you had a beautiful weekend. It's certainly a mixed bag weather-wise, but mostly very nice, and hopefully you enjoyed it. And even regardless of weather, you still had a very pleasant time not doing or doing whatever it is that you were doing, if that makes sense. For those of you who celebrate a weekend, I hope you got to celebrate it. If you didn't get to do it, well, hopefully you enjoyed doing what that was. We are here, we are back, and we're thrilled. We have a wonderful panel, and we welcome you to be a part of the program. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we welcome your letters as always. A great group this morning. Let me introduce them to you. First and foremost, WAMC's Alan Chartok. Good morning, sir. How are you?
I'm good, but hardly foremost. Pardon me. And I got to say, I'm very grateful. You know, Joe, and you've had so much to do with this. We have about a half a million people listening to this radio station every month. That's 500,000 people. That's a lot of people. We're the number one radio station in the region by far now. And so it's an extraordinary achievement that the members of this station have gotten together and created this thing. And I, frankly, am very grateful, as I say.
Well, it's certainly, yes, grateful is a great word, and a great word. I didn't want to do that. But anyway, great word, and absolutely, we're thrilled, and we thank you all for your love and support, as we always thank you for. We, as I mentioned, have a great group this morning, and well, one of my favorite people on the planet is here, Libby Post, political consultant and lobbyist. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. And you are one of my favorite people in the universe. How's that?
Oh, that's one right. You got to one up me, don't you, Libby?
Yeah.
Well, it's good to hear your voice. And thank you very much for being with us, as you always are on a Monday morning.
I wouldn't be anywhere else.
Excellent. Sienna Freeman Tolbert is here, immigration attorney and partner with the Albany law firm of Whiteman, Osterman, and Hanna. Sienna, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Joe. I hope I'm part of the top 150.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, God. Oh, no. You're much higher than that. No, we're thrilled. We so appreciate you being with us last week as we were doing our show after the Derek Chauvin case, or the verdict, rather. And we're thrilled to have you on this morning. Always a pleasure to speak with you. Sarah Rogerson is also a great friend of this program. She's an Albany Law School professor and director of the Immigration Law Clinic. Good morning, Sarah. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. Happy Monday.
Happy Monday, indeed. I'm going to start off with a story that is not happy. In fact, it's very concerning and really tragic if you look at it. And we have been looking at it over the last, seeing pictures over the last several days that are just tragic and horrifying. The Biden administration, under growing pressure to offer more assistance to India as it struggles to contain a devastating coronavirus outbreak, promised Sunday to provide new aid, including the materials for making vaccines. The pledge came hours after Indian authorities announced another global record in new daily cases Sunday, the most COVID-19 deaths the country has suffered in a 24-hour period. The National Security Council said the United States would provide vaccine materials, drugs, test kits, ventilators, and personal protective equipment. Just as India sent assistance to the U.S. as our hospitals were strained early in the pandemic, the U.S. is determined to help India in its time of need, President Biden tweeted on Sunday. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said in a statement Sunday evening that the department is currently assessing the equipment we can both procure and draw from our own inventory in the coming days and weeks to help India's healthcare workers. He added that the department will assist with delivering supplies, including oxygen-related equipment, to India in the next few days. The Prime Minister of India delivered his monthly radio address on Sunday, urging citizens to get vaccinated as the devastating new wave of infections threatened to overwhelm the nation's health services. Meanwhile, details emerged of the government's efforts to block criticism of its response to the outbreak on social media. India did weather a surge in September that approached nearly 100,000 new infections a day, but then numbers dropped dramatically, creating the impression the country was defeating the virus. However, starting in March, the number of new cases has exploded to new highs, topping 300,000 for the past 4 days. Sunday's count of 300,000 149,691 new cases in the previous 24 hours was the most for any country in a 24-hour period during the pandemic. 2,767 deaths reported just Sunday was a new high for India. Experts caution that the figures are undercounts in the nation of more than 1.3 billion people. A tragic, horrible situation. Alan, your thoughts?
That's a lot of people, of course. You know, you step back and you can think of all kinds of political reasons we should be helping India. But forget that. We should be doing it because it's right. It's the best kind of international relations we could be engaged in. And we are doing that. And it is reflective of Joe Biden and his approach to an international flavor for his administration. You know, rather than dividing, which was, of course, his predecessor's way of trying to attract votes, he has really done what you have to do in international relations. Help your friends. I mean, it will go a long, long way to making this right.
Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, it's tragic and sad and terrible. And my thoughts are largely with my friends in the Indian American community, many of whom are experiencing deep grief, you know, thousands of miles away, and watching all of this unfold in a country that they still have deep ties to. And I'm hopeful for a return to diplomacy after the isolationist era of the Trump administration. I'm encouraged by a lot of the language coming out of this administration about the role of the United States in global humanitarian efforts. And I'll be watching closely, as I'm sure a lot of Americans will be, to see what kind of aid is offered and in what way. I mean, we're a far cry from the president throwing paper towels at people in Puerto Rico, I think it was, that image that just is seared in my head. You know, we're taking a turn back towards being a leader in both the global economy and the global care economy or the global circle of compassion, I guess is the better way to put it.
Sienna.
In addition to the humanitarian aspect of it, I wanted to point out the immigration aspect of it as well. As you know, the U.S. is the second most popular destination for Indians for living abroad. We have a lot of F-1 student visas, PhDs, H-1B, which is a temporary work visas, and just immigrants who work in my field, at least in the tech industry. So they send a lot of their highly educated individuals to the U.S. And it's important that, and there are really a lot in the industry. They're so populous. And this is one of the main areas, these are the foreign nationals that I work with probably the most. And so I'm seeing this the most. I'm seeing a lot of Indian foreign nationals who want to go home here on H-1Bs or F-1s, who want to be able to travel back and forth. And so it's important because they are such a piece of our fabric here in the U.S. that we support their home country. And so I know it's giving them a lot of ease this weekend to hear the president saying that because they are such an important part of our immigrant population here in the U.S.
Libby Post.
You know, I think I'm right about this, that Biden is the first world leader to be installed in office, elected in this country, and inaugurated during the pandemic or during the most ferocious part of the pandemic. And everyone, you know, used to say it's going to take years and years and years for the country to gain back its stature internationally because of the 4 years of the Orange Menace. And I think, you know, this is a COVID-informed administration. And I think that the fact that people, other countries are looking to the United States for help and for guidance, you know, shows that it doesn't, it takes much, but it doesn't take that much for us to go back to where we were. And, you know, I know that that's not the, the personalized part of this in terms of the impact that this is having on the people in India. But we can see, in a sense, when you have an autocrat type leader like India's president is, who sees politics as a total zero sum game, not being really ready for any of this, you know, oh, we got over it so we can relax everything, we're okay. And then you have this incredible surge where the class system in India is still pretty strong. And, you know, you have well off and you have poor. It's really a horrible situation for the people who are living there and the people who are struggling and looking for healthcare and looking for help. And once again, you know, I think the world will start turning to us because we have a responsible leader in the White House and someone who came in as a pandemic president.
The situation in India is dire, as we've been talking about. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this, the images that I referenced earlier of the overwhelmed crematories that are there, that that as one official referred to as a never-ending assembly line of death, is especially awful and really very difficult to look at and to see. We're somewhat used to these pictures because you know, we remember early in our fighting of the virus that we saw similar pictures of mass graves in this country. But over the last 2 weeks, governments in Delhi and Mumbai have announced restrictions on travel, weddings, shopping, and other activities. Speeding up vaccinations will be more complicated. About 10% of India's population has received at least one shot, leaving more than a billion people to vaccinate fully. So, as noted, a lot of people. To do so, India, who is a major vaccine manufacturer, has recently cut back on exporting doses. Indian officials have also criticized the Biden administration for not exporting more vaccine supplies to India, given the large U.S. supply. The U.S. said yesterday that it would do so. So let's talk about that criticism for a moment, Alan, as they were blocking the export of supplies that Indian vaccine makers say they need to expand production. And they're coming under, they came under fire for that. So what do you think the reason was for it, and how much, you know, the State Department said in response to questions about the export ban, the U.S. first and foremost is engaged in an ambitious and effective and so far successful effort to vaccinate the American people.
You know, Joe, I read it with great interest. I read the same words that you're telling us now with great interest. The truth is, there is truth here, and that is that we have to sit back and understand that politics is always at play. We don't want to understand that, but you better believe the people are sitting in Washington and they're making up their minds. Now that we've gotten pretty far ahead of the game where this is all concerned and people are getting vaccinated, except for the fools who don't want to get vaccinated or who won't take the second shot, we can afford to say to our people, and that's what politics in this country is all about, we can do the right thing when it comes to India. And I'm very excited about that. I think it's the right way to be. It's what we should be doing. And the Indians, of course, have their own issues because, you know, they manufacture vaccine there. Whether they were getting what they were manufacturing becomes important. But I think it's important to avoid, Joe, the blame game here. And the blame game always starts, we should have, they should have. But The way to look at this right now is that we're doing the right thing.
Sarah?
Yeah, but it does matter how we're doing the right thing, and it does matter what the details are in terms of what that looks like for the lived experience of the people in that country. And we haven't seen anything close. And there have been horrific stories in the United States at the height of the pandemic about, you know, the difficulty in taking proper care of bodies, the bodies of those who had died. But the images of the crematoriums and the length to which people have to go to properly dispose of bodies in this sort of like mass death scenario in India really is one of the more striking images of the fatal nature of this disease and how quickly and how rapidly and how broadly it strikes. And so our response is not proportionate to that. And it needs to be. You know, we have been responding to lots of countries in the world. This isn't our first time assisting globally in this pandemic. But like many other responses that we have on the humanitarian side, certain countries receive less favorable treatment than others. A lot of it has to do with politics, and some of it has to do with logistics. I think we don't know enough information to decide exactly what blame to place and where, but certainly there is enough to go around.
Libby?
I don't know if it's necessarily a blame game. I think it's... I think that there's certainly... perhaps what we would call misplaced priorities in a number of camps. But what needs to happen is that the vaccines need to get to the people, and the people, you know, need to be vaccinated and comply with whatever restrictions there are at the moment so that they can get back to a normal life. But I have to tell you, Joe, the picture that was on the cover of yesterday's Sunday New York Times was just horrific and really was illustrative of what's going on there in terms of these mass cremations of bodies. And the ground was just charred. It was just charred. And it was a horrible thing to think about having to live through that. And, you know, yes, we had our own, you know, refrigerator trucks here in New York State and all over the country.
And Hart Island, too. I just want to point out, I got a letter from somebody calling me out saying that there were no mass graves, but we saw
right.
I'm going to pause you real quick, Libby, just because we have to take a break. So hold your thought.
Okay.
Please write it down. Don't forget. And we'll get right back to you as soon as we come back after the break. We welcome your letters. Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Playing the music from the Pixar film Soul, which won Best Original Music and which was the score, won the Academy Award last night, also won Best Animated Feature and does have great music. So we're playing that this morning. The playlist is posted online at WAMC.org/roundtable. I'm glad we're playing the music because it reminds me that there was at least something entertaining about last night's Oscars presentation. Okay, with that said...
A little bit.
And what'd you think?
Well, I thought it was a little, it harkened back to the original Oscars. If you've ever seen any of the black and white footage, they were in a smaller space sitting around tables eating dinner.
Yeah.
And there was a dais up front. And so, you know, this just goes to prove that I'm a font of worthless information, but it did harken back for me to that scene. And I was very happy to see that Soul won because we watched it and I thought it was a wonderful movie, and it really, you know, speaks to what we're talking about this morning. Yeah. I mean, there are hundreds and thousands of souls now missing out of India, and because of this pandemic. And, you know, that picture in the New York Times, what I was going to say before, was horrific, and it showed, you know, an outdoor crematorium is not something we've seen, at least not in this country. And it really, it really brought the horror of all of this home.
It certainly did. Absolutely. I was really struck too by, you know, just sort of the helplessness there too, of dealing with it, of dealing with the virus, and thinking that you have control. And we just heard in the BBC news of okay, but this is still better than lockdowns. And you like, I don't get, right, Alan? I mean, this is what we've been talking about for over a year.
Yep. Yeah, you certainly are right about that. You know, I go to bed at 6:30 because I have to be up by 2 every morning, so I didn't see it. But I read about it this morning. I hadn't seen any of the films. I don't know any of the actors. And so, therefore, I'm the last guy who should be talking about this.
Well, you know who Anthony Hopkins is.
I do, and I think he's terrific. You're so right. And thank you for that criticism. I really deserved it. Appreciate it.
Anytime.
Indeed.
All right. So let's go on to another story this morning that I'd like to talk about in relation to the virus. The EU is setting to let vaccinated U.S. Tourists visit this summer. The head of the European Commission said the bloc would switch policy under certain conditions after more than a year, mostly banning non-essential travel. American tourists who have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19 will be able to visit the EU over the summer, the head of the bloc's executive body said in an interview with the New York Times on Sunday. More than a year after shutting down non-essential travel from most countries to limit the spread of the coronavirus, the fast pace of vaccination in the U.S. and advanced talks between authorities there and the European Union are over how to make vaccine certificates acceptable as proof of immunity for visitors will enable the European Commission, the executive branch of the European Union, to recommend a switch in policy that could see transatlantic leisure travel restored. Alan.
Well, you know, this is interesting because there is this tension between opening up and protection. I'm on the protection side. I have that individual discussion with Roselle a lot here. I think, you know, once we've both had our shots, she's more for opening things up. But every once in a while, we read something that's quite alarming in the newspapers about somebody who got the COVID after they got the shots and all the rest of it. I think it's too early to open things up as much as we'd like. On the other hand, we were in New York City last weekend and we ate out. We ate out under what I would consider to be the right circumstances. I have friends who tell me that they still haven't gone out of their house. So this is a national and international and a personal debate that people are having.
Sienna.
Personally, I favor the 3 to 5 day test prior to travel. I think that was a very good policy that we had, and I think that's what they should be implementing. I think everyone should have a test, viral test, 3 to 5 days before they, a negative viral test, 3 to 5 days before they travel. I think that's the best way to make sure that, you know, to ensure that no one's traveling, you know, carrying the virus with them as they travel in and out of these different countries. I think that's the best practice, even for people that are fully vaccinated. Because as you know, we're going to have issues with people having fraudulent vaccination forms. So I still think we should adhere to some sort of testing prior to travel, just to ensure that there's no, you know, we're not traveling with the virus and continuing to spread it in different countries.
I could live with that.
Sarah?
Well, it's exciting to see the headline. I saw it pop up this weekend and thought, oh, my initial thought was just excitement, right? Like, I think it's been a long time since anyone has we're so used to
the life that we've been living for over a year now. Things that were ordinarily normal now seem exotic and exciting. That being said, my next thought was, you know, this privileges people who have access to the vaccine. This also, like, we're not real sure about, you know, as a parent, whether kids can travel, if it's restricted to people who have been vaccinated. You know, what does that say for kids? And my kids are starting to feel a little left behind, you know. The adults are all excited. The adults get to do things that they haven't done in the past. You know, there are flights that can happen now that couldn't happen before. And they're like, well, you know, we're still wearing our masks and going to school and social distancing. Like, when does any of this trickle down to the youth, right? And at the same time, we see a surge in mental health crises for youth. So, while I'm tempted to be excited, even though I'm not in any position to go anywhere for the foreseeable future, even as a vaccinated person, I don't even know what that would be like to be on an airplane, to be honest. I don't know. I don't.
It sounds
horrifying.
It would
feel very weird.
Yeah.
Right. It's very anxiety provoking. Like, sitting in a can very close to hundreds of strangers. Like, I'm not up for that. But, you know, these countries really rely on American tourism in order to boost their economies. And so the EU has a lot of financial incentive to open up to whatever they can as safely as they can in terms of international travel and business. So I guess one step at a time, and hopefully this doesn't lead to flare-ups of the pandemic or of the of any mutations of COVID-19 or the original virus itself.
Libby.
Well, you know, we were in New York City last weekend, I think it was, also, and to see some family. And it was amazing how empty the streets were on Monday morning or Tuesday morning. I can't remember which morning we were there. I think it was Tuesday morning. You know, at 9:15 we were out, and you know, you could walk across the street and not get hit by anybody. I mean, it was not by a car, but like just by people. But I think the ability to travel is going to be a case by case, but also a class basis. Those who can afford it will be able to go and travel if they want to do that. I know that, you know, cabin fever has struck many of us, and we do want to get out and get someplace, go someplace else. And the vaccinations are helping that. And I think tourism dollars are very important to the economy, our economy in the United States, the economy in other countries. There was 60 Minutes last night. There's 100,000 people who are dependent on Broadway and the arts in New York City, and you know, they're missing paychecks, and that's really tourism driven. So, you know, I think that, you know, I don't want to do this America First thing, but if we're going to travel, let's travel local, or at least, you know, to get the economy going, and for those who can go, you know, have fun, just be safe.
And that's the big issue of mm-hmm. for us all to be safe, and how different it is within each of these quote unquote United States. So the situation right. in Michigan is very different than it is in New York, as it is in Texas, or it is in California, which is hard to figure out too, because we have issues, right, Alan, with not just international travel, but figuring out how to go to Chicago.
Yeah, it's tough. It's a tough thing. You know, there are those of us who are naturally conservative about all of this. And then there are those people who are so anxious to have it all opened up that they're willing to take risks. You know, to me, a man with wonderful grandchildren and children and the rest of it, I just want to see everybody safe. You know, maybe I'm wrong. It certainly is possible.
Well, I think you're right to want everybody safe.
No, that's right. I want everybody safe, but maybe I'm wrong and too cautious is my point. But I don't think you can be too cautious. On the other hand, you have the economy, Joe. You want it opened up. People right. want to travel. You want people here. Tourism. Libby talked about the streets being emptied on Monday. You talk about all the people who I remember lying in bed in New York City, and I as a guy who lived on 96th Street, when I hear sirens, I know I'm home.
Right.
But I have to say, on when we got there on Thursday night, there were sirens. Friday night and Saturday night, there were no sirens in New York City. I mean, the city, in so many ways, Libby's absolutely right, has shut down, and that's bad too. So it's got to be a sort of lifting with both hands, one against the other.
Go ahead.
We hit the George Washington Bridge, at 4:15 on Monday afternoon.
Right.
We got right across the bridge, and it took 10 minutes to get down the West Side Highway. That's how empty.
New
wow.
Yorkers.
Yeah.
Yep.
Oh, we'll be swearing in no time at all the traffic, but
I know, you know, it's true.
Enjoy it while it happens. Well, anyway, let's take a break. When we come back, we have a lot of letters from folks. We'll go to those, and then we will move on to other topics. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will be right back. That music, just to remind you that Trent Reznor was involved in that soundtrack. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. Lots of letters. Let's go to them. John says the situation in India is spiraling out of control. Nevertheless, the EU is rushing to allow vaccinated Americans to visit this summer. Are government officials completely out of their mind? This is a global pandemic. Russ says, Alan, if we should avoid playing the blame game, then you shouldn't be describing people in this country who don't want to get vaccinated as foolish. That may be your opinion, but at the same time, you are inferring that they may be to blame for their actions.
Inferring is one thing, saying is another. I didn't say it. I can tell you right now, I do believe it's foolish. I'm sticking with it. You can have your opinion, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Just the person saying at the end there to blame for their actions. I mean, if you don't get, I realize I'm playing with fire here, but if you don't get vaccinated, then right? I mean, then you know, if you don't get vaccinated, then you and you get other people sick, then you are to blame. I don't know. How do you look around that? I don't see that.
It's you know, it really not to get a vaccination in this country at this time is foolish. Now, foolish is a word I'm using because I'm trying to avoid alienating our writer by saying stupid.
Chuck writes, some countries like people are a power of example. Some are a warning to others. India is a warning. Stay the course. Don't open up too soon and follow the science. Do the next right thing. You guys are nuts, says Tony. New York City is full of traffic and life. We've had plenty of traffic, and the Upper West Side is bustling. Why does everyone who doesn't live here make these pronouncements?
I was there. I said Thursday night, there were sirens, not that many. On Friday and Saturday, I heard none. Now, either something's happening to my ears or, you know, that seems to be evidence.
Well,
to me.
And Libby, who was also there, had the same very similar reaction. Right, Libby?
Yeah. It was quiet.
And the premise of the letter was we weren't there. Well, we were.
Heather says, thank you for bringing up the kids. I don't know why we are having these conversations about the community at large when an entire population cannot get vaccinated. Unfortunately, many parents do not seem particularly concerned as many unvaccinated adults, and I do worry that this will cause spreading, which causes mutations. We really need to slow down. My daughter is 11 months old, and I know even though I'm vaccinated and my husband is, we'll be adhering to the quote-unquote rules to keep her safe. Absolutely.
Good letter, and I absolutely agree with it, and I've been thinking that all along. I'm sure the medical people know what they want in holding the kids, holding off on the kids. Nevertheless, it seems to me it's a pretty good idea that if it's right and if it's medically correct to vaccinate them, that we should get to that, because we are seeing increases in younger people with the disease.
Carol says she lives at 28th and 9th Avenue, and there are far too many sirens there, just for whatever.
Yeah. It's the wrong side of town.
Yeah. Dale writes, all of the help offered by the USA for India is fine, but I noticed that their main request was for a waiver for patent protection, a waiver on trade and intellectual property rules for COVID-19, and that has not yet been granted by the Biden administration. You need to demand your leaders stop blocking the measure. It is ethical, humane, and frankly, will keep you safe. Then we go to Jennifer. I am afraid the panel is falling into a bit into dear leader mentality this morning. Yes, Biden should get some credit for what he finally did Sunday, but this is 10 days after aid was requested by the Indian government. It took the awful images and public pressure to get them to finally move. The delay really was unfortunate. Anyone want to address that? Hearing none, we go to Mike.
If I addressed it, it would be out of total ignorance, because I'm not in possession of those facts. You know, people can write any letter they want. I just don't know. It seems to me that Biden should be credited for doing the right thing.
Mike says, what might work? Physicians calling their patients and telling them directly why they should be vaccinated and answering any of their concerns. It will be harder for reluctant patients to argue with their doctors than to ignore the media messages about vaccination. AMA should initiate a campaign urging doctors to contact their patients.
How about both?
Yeah, that's right.
How about the doctor does it and the media does it and everybody does it in order to protect all those lives?
Well, and then there was the story that broke in the Times over the weekend with data, which I'm trying to pull up right now, of the actual numbers, but of the millions of people who are skipping their second dose is becoming a real problem.
Yeah.
8% of those who got initial Pfizer or Moderna shots missed their second doses. And officials in New York State want to prevent that number from rising. That is a very, I mean, to me, that's a high number. The reasons are varied. For why people are missing their second shots. Some people said they feared the side effects, which can include flu-like symptoms. Others said they felt like they were sufficiently protected from just a single shot. Those attitudes were expected, say health officials, but another hurdle has been surprisingly prevalent. A number of vaccine providers have canceled second dose appointments because they ran out of supply or didn't have the right brand in stock. I know this happened to a friend of mine where they had their first shot at Pharmacy A, and then they went back to Pharmacy A to get their second shot 3 or 4 weeks later to find out that that pharmacy now was stocked with the opposite vaccine. And then you have to find another pharmacy that would have that vaccine that would give you the second shot, which often became difficult. So I wasn't going to name a company, but the New York Times does, so I'll read what they say. Several Walgreens customers said in interviews that they scrambled in some cases with help from pharmacy staff to find somewhere to get the correct second dose. Others presumably simply gave up because it was difficult. From the outset, public health experts worried that it would be difficult to get everyone to return for a second shot 3 or 4 weeks after the first dose. It is no surprise that as vaccines are rolled out more broadly, the numbers of those skipping their second dose have gone up. So what do you do about that problem?
Well, you know, having eschewed the blame game earlier, I would say that I think I remember, and I wonder if anybody else on the panel does, I think I remember reading in the paper that there was some proof, and this came from some of the health people, that the first shot covered you, that you didn't absolutely need the second shot. Now, of course, I don't believe that for a minute because that's who I am. Nevertheless, I think to some degree that's what's behind this.
Well, it certainly was partial in the interviews that the Times did, but they do say that I think it came up for many people of what level you were protected, but the big question was for how long, right? It was then how long does that last and give you the full protection?
And we still don't know.
And we don't know the answer to that. Right, exactly.
Well, not only that, but for those with the Pfizer vaccine, at least, we have to go back again for a third, is what they're saying. A booster might be necessary.
Probably in a year, right?
You know,
a year from your last.
Yeah, or even sooner. I thought it was 6 months, but maybe I'm confusing the issues. Maybe that's just the Excelsior Pass is only good until August.
Yes, the Excelsior Pass is good. Well, although yours may vary. Like mine was good because I don't know. I got mine 3 weeks ago, and mine now is good through the end of September.
What is yours, Joe?
The Excelsior Pass. It was a Pfizer vaccine.
So you get
your Excelsior Pass, and then they tell you that that's good. I don't know, Sarah, have you found anywhere to use it? I want to use it somewhere, but I haven't. I don't know where you show off.
Yeah.
That you get.
Well, you know, when I've been reading the articles about SPAC reopening and some of the music venues, I think you'll need to use it for that. We'll need to use it for Albany Law's commencement. We're going to have actually two commencements. We're graduating the class of 2020 that never got to graduate properly, and the class of 2021 on the same day. Different ceremonies and SPAC has a whole protocol around that. And the Excelsior Pass, it just makes it easier because it's like a one-stop shop that people can scan and get all of your health information.
That's right.
It's trading privacy for convenience in order to gain entry to things. Which again, you know, if you don't need to use your pass very often, that's probably a sign that you're contributing to the social good of keeping everybody safe because we're not out of this yet.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, the story about noncompliance really makes me think about whether or not people are going to get their boosters, right? Because if they don't, then there's a chance that we could see another mini wave, you know, again. And if when people were saying last March that it might take us years to get out of this, I just couldn't believe that to be true. I couldn't wrap my head around. I just thought, no, that's not a reality I'm going to accept. And sure enough, little by little, we're seeing just how pernicious and how persistent this virus is. And compliance is key. We need people to comply.
I have two questions that maybe you guys can answer or somebody in the audience can. I live in Massachusetts. There is no Excelsior Pass, obviously. I'm wondering if there is an equivalent here. I don't think so. I don't think I've heard about it, but it's possible. I've been looking in the wrong places. So that would be interesting. And, of course, a lot of us go across the border to New York State, and that raises a whole other bunch of questions.
Yeah, in Massachusetts, according to the state website, they want you to use your card, your vaccination card, as proof. I don't know, and then there's all this about the fake cards and how they're being sold in the black market. So I don't know how they're going to deal with that, but I assume probably something will be put into gear. And I'm sorry, what was the second question?
And that's the question of I think of we may need the third Pfizer shot. But I don't think it's been announced yet that we do need it. I think there's a big difference, right?
Yes. I'm looking that up, but they're saying, I thought they said that my understanding was, well, I'll look it up during the break and then I'll come back and report.
God for breaks.
Yes, thank God for breaks. for two major reasons.
Yes, I know the first.
we'll take said break and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman-Tolbert, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. And we thank you for being with us this morning. We were, right before break, we were talking about the shot, the Pfizer shot in particular, about what we know of getting a neck shot. And the information goes back to last Wednesday. The scientist behind the Pfizer vaccine said on Wednesday that people are likely going to need a third dose of the COVID-19 vaccine and then annual shots. the company, that comment from the scientist echo what the Pfizer CEO expressed earlier in the week, last week, when he said people would require a booster shot of the vaccine within a year, which would mean this December for those who were first in line originally. However, researchers are unsure of how long immunity to COVID-19 lasts after receiving the vaccine, though data from Pfizer and Moderna have shown that their shots are highly effective 6 months in, but it remains to be seen how well the vaccines fare after that point. So I hope that answers that question somewhat, but the basic answer is they don't know for sure.
I'm sure everybody is thinking what I'm thinking, which is we had a hell of a time getting the shots in the first place. Now, when you need a third shot, is it going to be equally as difficult, or because you've had your shots, is it going to be easier? That's going to be an important question.
Yeah, and especially when we wonder what the situation is going to be, let's say in December, where because they're now saying that supply far exceeds demand or is expected to within just two or 3 weeks. Will that still be the case in December, January, February of next year as people seek their booster or their third vaccine, however that works out to be?
And it would be nice to know.
The good news is that we're asking these questions now. You know, it would have been really nice to have 6 months or more of a lead time before the virus hit in order to put its systems in place. And from my experience in sort of crisis lawyering responses, particularly in the immigration context and under the Trump administration, where there was an emergency order impacting thousands of people every other Friday, what we found was that the systems that we all collectively built together consistently improved with each wave. So it was like the same, even though the problem changed, it was the same system's response or a similar system's response. You know, sometimes we eliminated things that weren't working and incorporated new things. And as new ideas developed, we brought them into the, so it's all about crisis response. And under this administration, I have a lot more faith that there is that active sort of cycle of reflection happening after each problem crops up. You know, whether it's compliance or rollout or, you know, the wrong, you know, which vaccines are going to which pharmacy, a lot of the logistical details. You know, we have really great logistical minds in this country that can be brought in a public-private partnership to sort of sort some of the stuff out. Amazon can deliver vaccines in a way and can come up with systems to deliver vaccines in a way that has terrifying accuracy and provide you with 15 reminders that you don't need to reorder your vaccine, right? Like, so we should be able to bring in all of the finest and best minds to bear on this sort of like logistical issue. And maybe fix the Postal Service while we're at it.
You know, do you think that the drug is going to give us the shot, though?
I'm sorry, Libby, say that again.
Think that the Amazon drone will give us the shot as well?
No, I'm really half joking about that. It's really not a serious solution. But you know, the systems behind that, what's the computer program? What are the computer programs? What are the databases? What are the touch points? What is the human psychology around things like we use psychology to get people to buy stuff all the time. We should be able to use it more directly in public health campaigns to get them to comply with the elimination of an outbreak, right? So these are things that we can start to incorporate now that we're not in constant crisis response mode. You know, before we had the vaccine, it was worse. But there were these systems being built then, governments coming together that hadn't come together before, you know, government offices stretching themselves outside of their comfort zone and to be flexible and to be creative in the response, right? We had mass distribution of PPE early on, remember, by people that you wouldn't expect to be engaged in that sort of an effort because it was a crisis moment. And now we have a little bit more time to be more deliberate and bring in more minds. So I don't want the Amazon drone to be involved in the operations on the ground, but I do want the minds behind it to be informing whatever government process is going to roll this out as we head into a third round of vaccination.
We did get go ahead, Libby. Or Santa, who was trying to talk?
No, it was me.
Okay, go ahead.
You know, it's also going to be end up being, you know, like getting your yearly flu vaccine, right? We're going to end up getting a yearly COVID booster or a COVID vaccine, and people will just have to get used to it once everybody's vaccinated and we know what the protocol is going to be. I mean, to not only educating the public on this, but people taking personal responsibility on it as well to make sure they do what they're supposed to do.
You know, I'm fascinated. You know, I'm fascinated, Lib. I'm fascinated by the fact that, you know, in the beginning, we began to lessen who could give you the shot, right? Am I wrong about that? In other words, in the beginning, there were either physicians or nurses or those. And then the reason I'm raising this is I remember a long time ago, we'll get calls on this one. I remember a long time ago when I was getting allergy shots, I was permitted to give myself the injection.
Yeah.
So one wonders when you talk about Amazon delivering the stuff, whether that isn't closer to the mark than you might believe. You know, it comes in the mail and you give yourself the shot if you can do it. Yeah. I'm sure there will be people who say, no, that's a very bad idea for all kinds of reasons. But I did it and I didn't find it very difficult.
Yeah. Giving yourself a shot is very weird. I had to do that for a long time and it's not. It's weird, but because
but
go ahead.
You do it if you have to do it.
You're coming in and out, Libby. I'm sorry.
Something's happening.
Yeah, you're crackling. You feel like you're deteriorating, and I know before
right
us.
Before our very eyes.
Yeah. So maybe just if you want to disconnect and reconnect, that would be cool. And
okay.
You do that, and I'll read a couple of letters in the meantime. We'll do some traveling music for Libby as she reconnects. Tom writes and says, President Biden, VP Harris, and Governor Cuomo were all vaccine deniers while President Trump was in office. They were all on record as saying they did not trust his vaccine. Now we expect everyone to get on board. Come on and get real. I remember being a part of those conversations of saying if we saw Dr. Fauci get the shot, we would get the shot. And that's where it was, right?
We should get the shot. Can you hear me now?
We can.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I was just going to say that giving yourself a shot it's strange, but it's not out of the realm of possibility.
No.
Because I've had to do it.
Yep.
But, you know, the other thing is that I know that they're training up lots of different kinds of human service folks and public safety folks to
EMTs,
give the shot.
EMTs, firefighters. Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yep.
Exactly right.
Okay, let's see. We go to there was a quick the question. I just want to go on this about the person saying that everybody was saying that they were vaccine deniers. I think, in fairness, I understand what the listener's saying, but in fairness, I mean, this came during the whole bleach controversy of saying, oh, okay, but, you know, if we're putting this, maybe we want to know what's in the vaccine. We weren't getting full information. I think that information is out. So, yeah, when we have a safe vaccine, and that seems to be primarily the case, right?
Yes.
Right. Autumn says, I got the Pfizer vaccine. According to the New York State Pass app, it will expire tomorrow, but it doesn't say what to do after the expiration date. I got fully vaccinated on January 26, 1921. If your panel knows anything, I would appreciate it. I would try, if I were you, Autumn, I would try to re-enter your information upon the expiration and see what happens. But because that is what I heard, that it would be updated. So let's see where that goes. But it's a great question. Beth says the message that boosters will be needed is coming from the CEOs of the drug companies who would be selling the boosters. Ah, the plot thickens. The message from some immunological doctors slash scientists is that boosters may not be needed because of memory T and B cell development, which will offer lasting protection. So that's an interesting point, you know, of distrust of the pharmaceutical companies of saying, well, they just want to sell you more of the stuff. What are the scientists saying of what you need? Fair point.
Totally healthy to be distrustful of corporate America. I have, you know, that was another of my reactions to the idea of a booster to begin with. But there's just so much. Just imagine how much we're learning on a rolling weekly basis about the vaccine, how it interacts with our bodies, what it does and doesn't do. The studies are underway currently. So by the time the booster question reaches a zenith, and, you know, you can bet that corporations aren't mass producing the boosters yet because they don't know if it's in their economic best interest to do so. So it'll be an interesting summer for science. And it's healthy to be skeptical of any sort of guidance that comes from corporations about your health.
So we're going to change the subject here. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Vice President Kamala Harris said on Sunday, the ultimate goal of diplomatic efforts on immigration by the Biden administration is to, quote, give people some sense of hope. She told CNN's Dana Bash on the State of the Union program, quote, we have to give people some sense of hope that if they stay, that help is on the way. It's not going to be solved overnight. It's a complex issue. If it were easy, it would have been solved years ago. The vice president has taken a lead on immigration in recent months following spikes in migration at the U.S.-Mexico border. So we have blessed to have two experts on the subject on our panel this morning. Sienna, let me go to you first.
I think it was a good effort that she's going to be working with community-based organizations in these Central American countries, but it's not enough, right? It's not enough to stop the flow. Right now, as I said before, right now the cartels, the coyotes, the people that are bringing these individuals up, they are telling them that this is the best time to come to the U.S. That's what they're saying because you're paying them $10,000, $15,000 sometimes for this trip to the U.S.-Mexico border. And so it's in their best interest to continue to tell these foreign nationals in Central America that this is the best time for you to come to the border because they're making money. And unfortunately, their voices are louder right now than what's going on in terms of what Vice President Kamala Harris is saying on the news, on the Sunday news program. And we have to do a better job of connecting to these foreign nationals and informing them of how the U.S. is going to step in and protect them from the cartels. That's what's going on. We have law enforcement in Central America that, you know, is corrupt. You know, and the gang cartels are making these, they're in danger. I mean, when I speak to a client, what they're saying is they're hiding in their house because they want to recruit their son, or they want to, you know, or they want to harm their daughter, or they want to harm the parent, and they're running. And so we really need to do more immediate action in Central America and really get on the ground. And so that's why it's good to see she's saying community-based organizations and not just the government. Mm. But it has to be more if you want to see some changes in the near future.
Vice President Harris also said, quote, we're making progress, but it's not going to be in evidence overnight. Part of the problem is that under the previous administration, they pulled out essentially a lot of what had been the continuum of work. It essentially came to a standstill. We have to rebuild it. And I made it very clear to our team that this has to be a function of a priority that is an American priority and not just a function of whoever is sitting in this chair. Sarah Rogerson.
Yeah, that's hopeful language. That's evidence of a humanity first response as opposed to an America first response. I agree with Sienna. It's not going to be enough. It's not going to be immediate. It's heartening. I agree with her that Vice President Harris is signaling a return to deep and constructive development work in these countries, which really there are push and pull factors that bring people to the United States. And what has been neglected for so, so long are the push factors, the systemic poverty, the corruption, the destabilization of governments that in some cases we have been the destabilizing force at various points in history. And so it's sort of 4 years isn't enough. 2 years definitely isn't enough. I appreciate the vice president's focus on making sure that no matter who's in the office, this becomes more of a normative signal from the United States that we're interested in both the push factors and the pull factors. But yeah, it's going to take a long time, and they're right to say that it's going to take a long time. I just want to make sure that this administration doesn't hide behind that when things get tough and they have to make tough calls that require the expenditure of political capital. That's where the problems arise. Like, you know, putting off all of the immigration reform debate, subjugating it. The last time I was on this program talking about the refugee cap being set at, you know, historically the lowest levels in American history, and keeping that cap, which was really a Trump era decision. So there are some easy things that they're not doing that they're then saying, oh, it's so complicated, we can't figure it out, or it's going to take more time for us to figure it out. There are certain things that they're still not doing that they could be doing to alleviate the crunch, which was rightly created through Trump-era policies. And quite honestly, Obama-era policies before that, right? So we saw, I think it was over this past week, former President George W. Bush coming out to sort of issue a rare public statement on the importance of immigration to our economy and urging Americans, like from a normative standpoint, to say, why do we, you know, we should be embracing our the immigrants that are arriving now, and we should have a pro-immigration mindset in this country, because it's really, and this is sort of the Republican viewpoint, it's also a pro-economy standpoint. So I always have mixed feelings whenever this administration speaks on immigration, and I feel like generally they're going in the right direction. I just constantly worry that a lot of the easier things that can be done now are being masked in this message of how complicated it is.
Mm. Alan. Oh, go ahead. Sienna, go ahead. Good, Alan.
I know. Sarah and I can probably do this all day about what's going on, but what's happening is, what's happening is, when women get to the border and when they're coming through the system, those same Trump policies are still in place. So those asylum decisions that were issued by Attorney General Jeff Sessions when he first was in office, those are still being implemented by our immigration courts. And that is something simple and not as complex for them to overturn. You know, that's something the Attorney General now that he could address. And so we're still dealing with Trump policies, and I think that's the push in the country. I think that's the frustration for a lot of individuals practicing in immigration and seeing the impact. So even though they're coming in, they're also being deported because they can't meet the new standard, the new higher standard. So that's also a whole other conversation.
Alan.
Rocking a hard place. This is the toughest thing that they are contending with right now. They don't know what to do. You know, we have two wonderful people on the panel who are advocates of opening things up a little bit more. But the American people have to be tested, and I'm sure they're polling like crazy. And I think they probably know that they're going to be judged on whether the system is overwhelmed. You know, to me, every sympathy should be given to the people who want to come in and protect their children and protect their lives in this country. Nevertheless, I wouldn't want to be them on this issue.
Libby?
You know, I think I keep coming back to the fact that almost all of us are immigrants or forced here in some way. This has been an issue that has been plaguing this country for, you know, for years. I mean, you know, before the end of World War II, you know, we weren't letting the Jews in. I mean, you know, from Nazi Europe, and you know, different groups have been alienated and stigmatized. It's something we have to figure out. The problem is going to be, we have a Congress that's so polarized and politics that are so polarized that to come together and really try and figure this out constructively is going to be nearly impossible because of the people who are continuing the obstructionist ways of the Orange Menace. And so, you know what I mean?
Yes,
so.
I do. Once again, I'm in the unenviable position of having to
pause. Cutting you off.
Yes, we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Alan Chartok, Sienna Freeman Tolbert, Libby Post, and Sarah Rogerson. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. Libby, what else did you want to say?
Nothing. I'm good.
All right. I just want to make sure. Let's talk about Kevin McCarthy for a moment. He was on the Sunday news programs. Well, he was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace yesterday. He continued to defend former President Donald Trump's response to the January 6th insurrection, claiming in an interview that Trump was unaware the U.S. Capitol was being stormed until McCarthy called and urged him to tell his supporters to stop. Quote, "I was the first person to contact him when the riot was going on," McCarthy told Fox News Sunday host Chris Wallace. "He didn't see it, but he ended the call, telling me he'll put something out to make sure to stop this, and that's what he did. He put a video out later." The statement, however, contradicted McCarthy's initial response to Trump's role in the attack and a fellow GOP lawmaker's recollection of what had been a tense call between McCarthy and Trump. In addition, one Trump advisor told the Washington Post that the then president had been watching live television coverage of the riot as multiple people were trying to reach Trump and his aides and beg, that is the word, beg for help. Immediately after the insurrection, Representative Jamie Herrera Butler of Washington said McCarthy had relayed details of his call with Trump. Trump had, quote, initially repeated the falsehood that it was Antifa that had breached the Capitol, indicating that Trump would have already been aware of the siege when McCarthy spoke to him. So, of course, the big reason that this is still a story and why I assume that Chris Wallace wanted to have him on the program yesterday is that this is the man who very well could be the Speaker of the House if things change next year. It is no secret that Kevin McCarthy is a man who wants to be Speaker of the House and is looking to do whatever he can. But it is a weird back and forth that he's having. According to the Times reporting on this issue, as the end of the Trump presidency devolved into turmoil and violence, Mr. McCarthy faced a dilemma, one that has bedeviled his party for nearly 5 years. Should he cut Mr. Trump loose, as many Republicans were urging, or should he keep trying to make it work with an ousted president who remains the most popular motivating force inside the GOP? Mr. McCarthy chose the latter, and not for the first time. His extravagant efforts to ingratiate himself with Trump have earned him a reputation for being an alpha lapdog inside Mr. Trump's kennel of acolytes. I love that line. Nine days after Mr. Trump departed Washington, there was Mr. McCarthy paying a visit to Mar-a-Lago, the former president's Florida estate, in an effort to, quote, keep up a dialogue with the volatile former president. Alan, let's go to you first.
Disgusting and disheartening. People lost their lives in that January 6th mess. He got on the phone. He begged. Trump was watching television. You know, these big lies about Trump didn't know anything about it. It really is awful that there are so many people in this country who believe that garbage.
Libby?
Well, I'm going to quote Alan, and I hope I get this right. He's a lying liar, liar, liar.
I was going to use it. I decided not to.
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, I kind of miss it. Go ahead.
I remember watching Trump on the news, watching the he was in a big white like catering tent with the TV, and his family were there, and they were all watching what was going on, and they were all smiling and joking around and thinking that it was great. So McCarthy, you know, is
disgusting.
He's drunk way too much Kool-Aid, and is losing. I mean, he's losing credibility among those who think. Whether or not he loses credibility among his electorate and or the Trump acolytes, you know, remains to be seen. But he's lying through his teeth, and he knows it. And as the article said, he's purely, like Trump, purely a transactional politician with a zero-sum game perspective of politics. It's not about policy. It's only about power.
On Sunday, Mr. McCarthy was further pressed by the Fox News Sunday host, Chris Wallace, who asked whether Mr. Trump had sided with the January 6th rioters when the president told Mr. McCarthy in a phone call that day, according to a claim by another Republican House member, that the mob was, quote, more upset by the election than Mr. McCarthy. Mr. McCarthy had called Mr. Trump to tell him the mob had to stop. Mr. McCarthy sidestepped, saying Mr. Trump told him that he would, quote, put something out to make sure to stop this, and that's what he did. He put a video out later. Mr. Wallace replied quite a lot later, and it was a pretty weak video. Mr. McCarthy continued to dodge his role as Mr. Trump's chief envoy to Republicans in power. He is perhaps the most consequential member of the party in post-Trump Washington, in large part because of his chance of becoming the next Speaker of the House. Sarah.
I remember watching the debate between Trump and the other Republicans back in 20, whatever it was, when they were pre-primary. And I remember watching the debates of Trump and Hillary, right? And I remember thinking, you know what? The GOP, if they choose this joker, have dug their own grave, and we will, in the long run, I mean, back then I was thinking, this is just never, like, good luck, you know, you're going to lose the election, this is game over. And then, you know, when that didn't happen, and we all had to reckon with what did happen, I thought, there's still an opportunity here, there's still a long game where the Republicans hitched their wagon to I'm trying to think of a non-controversial way to say this. There isn't really one. But they hitched their wagon to an amoral buffoon. And that's a tough wagon for a party that's built their reputation on Christian ideal morals, right? So I continue to be fascinated as the drama unfolds, and I just hope that we don't see another reckoning where we expect one thing to happen and, you know, the majority votes to have votes for hate and votes for America First and turns back away from humanity. I hope that doesn't happen.
You know, they're not going to give up on this. One of the things that's so fascinating is they're counting the Arizona votes again.
Yeah. That's so bizarre.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that. Santa, did you have anything to say about McCarthy? And then we'll go to the vote count real quick before we adjourn.
Nothing too illuminating, so please go for the vote.
All right. So yeah, the story is it's really fascinating. I mean, it's depressing as hell, but it's fascinating that they're still counting votes in Arizona half a year after Trump's defeat. Arizona Republicans are recounting the vote. An audit of the vote in Arizona's most populous county was meant to mollify angry Trump voters, but it is being criticized as a partisan exercise more than a fact-finding one. Surprising that that could have possibly happened. So a parade of flatbed trucks last week hauled boxes of voting equipment and 78 pallets containing the 2.1 million ballots of Arizona's largest county. went to a decrepit local coliseum. It kicked off a seat-of-the-pants audit process that seemed more likely to amplify Republican grievances than it did to put them to rest. After almost a year after the election, Mr. Trump lost. The promised audit has become a snipe hunt for skullduggery that has spanned a court battle, death threats, and calls to arrest the elected leadership of Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix. The head of the Florida-based firm that Republican senators hired to oversee the audit has embraced Mr. Trump's baseless theories of election theft and has suggested, contrary to evidence, that Mr. Trump actually won Arizona by 200,000 votes. The pro-Trump cable channel One America News has started a fundraiser to finance the venture and has been named one of the nonpartisan observers that will keep the audit on the straight and narrow. In fact, three previous reviews showed no sign of significant fraud of any reason to doubt President Biden's victory. But the senators now plan to recount by hand all 2.1 million ballots cast in Maricopa County, two-thirds of the entire vote statewide.
You know, Joe, I don't mind them recounting the vote, but that's not what I think is going to happen here. You can call me Ishmael, but whatever you want to call me, the fact is, I think they're going to cheat. They're going to say, hey, look, just like Trump had asked the Secretary of State, you remember before, to come up with whatever he needed, they're going to find what they need, and that is scary. Not that it'll change the election results, not that when it goes to the Supreme Court of the United States, they're going to change their minds about who won the election, but it's going to continue.
Libby?
I think it's just absolute political theater drama and absurdity. I mean, it's like, it's not going to do anything. I think Alan's probably right. They will conjure something, but it's not going to change the outcome of the election. And it's stupid. It's just downright stupid. I mean, I just don't, you know, you lost. Get over it. Move on. You're not going to get the presidency back. Somebody else was inaugurated, took the oath of office, moved in. It's over. I mean, and I get what they're trying to do to, you know, maintain the base. But, you know, Arizona is turning blue. And if they don't like that, I'm sorry. It's just the truth.
We have less than a minute, but either Sienna or Sarah, if you'd like to mention some of the legal questions going around in this. But go ahead.
Any time they've done a recount or done any investigation or probe or any of this stuff, they've turned up the fact that Republican operatives were responsible for interfering in the election. So go ahead. You know, whatever you find is going to Yeah, every time. I think Pennsylvania was the most recent one. Like, you know, they keep digging their own graves. Go for it.
Yeah, it's just absurd. It's just mind-blowing.
I find it very scary. I do. I know that we can dismiss it by saying, oh, there they go again. But the fact of the matter is that they were willing, on the day that the election was going to be certified, to send their people in there and try to decertify it. Very scary. Very scary, because the United States has not seen that. And now we're seeing the same thing going on with Arizona. Okay, I'm done.
No, okay. We're out of time. I'm sorry I had to cut there.
That's right.
Thanks to all. I appreciate it. We'll be back right after this.